space is not going to be different. We are going to have 100 years from now, we're going to be definitely settling the closest planetary bodies and their moons. I think more moon and Mars is definitely being integrated into human society and industry.
Hello and welcome to the New Space Vision podcast, sponsored by Lifeo, where we discuss new space technology, finance and innovation with executives, founders, and more exciting people from the startup new space ecosystem. I'm Daniel Seidel.
And I'm Sam Shivara, and together we are the founders of the Earth observation company Lifeo and New Space Vision. Today's guest has been a key person in the space economy since nearly 20 years. But his excitement about space exploration reaches even back longer than that. Already in kindergarten, he used to build rockets and was amazed by all flying things. And I think this is something Daniel and I share. So we are extremely happy to welcome Bülent Altan, who founded the space VC Alpine Space after being VP at SpaceX and being CEO at the satellite communication company Mynaric. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you, Sven, and happy to be here.
So you went from research in Stanford to SpaceX and then had a crazy career over there. So let's talk about the early days. How did you come to SpaceX and what did you do before in Stanford?
Well, my research or my engagement in Stanford was twofold. On one side, I was working on this project. It was a successor to Gravity Probe B. Gravity Probe B, this multi-decade project that Stanford worked on, something that Albert Einstein had come up with. And after decades, they were finally going to launch it and were looking at a successor mission. And that was together with actually quite a bit of European involvement. That was called LISA. And I was working on their payload side, on the payload processor, like processing a ton of data. And that's still going on over there. But in parallel to that, on Stanford, I used to also work with a bunch of friends on projects that we worked together with Professor Twiggs. Professor Twiggs, for people who may know, is one of the masterminds behind the whole idea of CubeSat. And he was just coming up with the idea, and the first ones were being developed. So we were working there with especially two really close friends of mine on a CubeSat mission for Stanford on a tether experiment. It was a 3 CubeSat tethered flight that we were working on. So it was a very hands-on way to do research. We were building hardware. We're writing software, we were coming up with a mission profile. And that's exactly what led us to joining SpaceX. It was really that group of students, my good friends, Paul and Steve, and I exactly got approached by SpaceX and learned about it and decided one by one to leave Stanford as soon as we got the diploma, even sometimes before, and just pack up our stuff and go from the Bay Area down to LA to join SpaceX. And I think it was that hands-on experience and that love of hands-on, really getting your hands dirty, that attracted SpaceX to us.
And then I assume it is very hard to get into such a company. So what was your qualification back then to join the company? How do you think you convinced SpaceX?
Interestingly, SpaceX was a little bit different back then. 2004, it was a garage shop with just a few tens of people. Like I was, I think, employee number 42 to enter back then. And it was still hard to get into. I don't want to say anything else, but it wasn't this prestigious company everyone knew about that you should go and join. It was even a company that a few of my professors came to me and said, "What are you doing? There is no such thing as private space flight. You're just throwing your career away." But I decided to give it a shot and went down to LA to talk to the people and talk to Elon, talk to Hans Koenigsmann, who was going to be my first mentor and boss, and had a conversation. And what they really wanted to know is someone who understands, of course, theory very well, really making sure that you know what you're doing in, of course, the book smarts way, but could translate that to real decision-making, real hardware making, have a knack for getting your hands dirty and building something. I think I had combined those two really well in my studies. I was a graduate of Technical University of Munich. Back then we had this program Diplom. So I had the equivalent of a master's in computer science, but I had worked in a satellite program my my whole time over there. It was called LunarSat, a moon orbiter that we were building out of Technical University of Munich. And then in Stanford, as I said, I was building CubeSats. And it was that hands-on combined with theoretical knowledge and good grades. All of that combined really got me in there. And that was mainly the focus of conversation with everyone I talked at SpaceX.
Nice. On your socials, you also posted a picture of the SpaceX team before Falcon 1's launch. And I think this is also in a book which came out recently. During the same time, a previous guest on the show, Johnny Dyer, who is now the CEO and founder of Miron Space, interned there in 2005. Just out of curiosity, do you remember him? Did your paths cross there?
Well, 2005 was a crazy year, but the company was small. So yes, we did know everyone that was going into the company, but I gotta say, I didn't have the pleasure of working with him closely. But yeah, 2005, we were just a handful of engineers. And I gotta also be honest, I spent most of my time in Texas testing engines. So yeah. that was an exciting year. And I'm sure that internship left a lasting impression.
Yeah. There are podcasts about exactly your time at SpaceX. There are books being written about the early times at SpaceX. So today we also really want to focus on exactly what you're currently doing and where you see exactly the space ecosystem developing. But maybe from your time at SpaceX, what was your biggest learning from that time at this company, which is fundamentally or has changed the space ecosystem like no other? What do you tell fellow space companies, future CEOs you are working with, what they should take on from that experience?
Well, there's a lot that one can pull out of an experience in SpaceX, but really crystallizing out of it, I think what really made SpaceX happen is quick decision making. I think that's a key, and especially for a CEO or for executive leadership of a company, space is a difficult topic. You tend to have never all the knowledge to make a 100% informed decision. And it goes contrary to academic belief that you should always strive to get 100% information to make a decision just to move forward in a failure is not an option method. Mm-hmm. Failure is not an option is a sentence that was said about spaceflight. And it was about losing human life on a failed moon mission. But it has been taken out of context so much, and it has been a bane of existence for the space industry. And it has put us in what we called back in SpaceX into analysis paralysis. Hmm. What you need to do in the space environment, because there is no way to get to 100% knowledge base to make a completely informed decision with no chance of failure, what you need to do is make a decision early with the information you have, and move on and get your learnings, even if you made a mistake. Mm. I think the worst decision is no decision, because you learned nothing. You learned absolutely nothing. So in my career, myself, people around me, Elon, we make quick decisions. Very often, the 80% decision is a very end of gut decision, is the right one. But we fell flat on our noses quite often as well. Oh man, there's a couple of decisions we completely regretted. But if your final decision is driven also by a few failures along the way, you really stand by that decision, because you know, and like, you don't have this constant feeling in the back of your head that, hey, what if I had tried that? Because I wanted to go that direction, but this was the safe bet. You tried it, it failed, you decided to pivot, done. It's always going to happen. Even if you think you had 100% the facts on the table, space is very quick to tell you you didn't. So all these failure is not an option, first time right, whatever you want to call it, never works in the space industry. Go have the balls to make decision. By the way, never bullshit your way into an answer. Really stay with the facts. And really be quick about it.
Very interesting that you mentioned it, because in the most recent Lex Fridman podcast with Jeff Bezos, he also talks the same way about Blue Origin, right? He wants to make it the fastest decision-making company out there. And I always had the feeling back then that in space, decisions are very, very slow, right? And I think that's maybe also you know, if people still use these terms, old space and new space, maybe one of the key differentiators, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that is in the core a part of decision-making difference between the two companies. And it comes from the way those companies work and actually have been pushed to work. So we're talking about some of these companies, the Boeings, the Lockheeds, and the Airbuses and whatnot, in a certain way, as if those companies are just a creation of their own. They're not. They're also a creation of their customer, which is very often government, which is in a different contracting structure that is this cost-plus structure. And it doesn't forgive mistakes like we do in the new space industry. You have a customer base that doesn't want to see mistakes along the way, even though that mistake-free way still ends up making mistakes and costs more, but yeah, your customer is pushing you for it. So I'm not really blaming anyone to end up with a structure like they do. It's just that's that type of business. New space is a different type of business. That's it.
So SpaceX was one of the first companies in this field to actually did it like that, right? From these early employees of SpaceX, do you see now also a lot of new space companies were founded by these guys? I mean, of course, Johnny Dyer is one example, but is there a group of people now?
Oh yeah, it's a huge amount of people building exciting startups. Some of them, most of them stay in the space domain, but not all of them. I have a good friend of mine who started an additive manufacturing company, Freeform Futures. I have friends who started portable nuclear power startups and whatnot, but then most of them stay in the space domain. Actually, with Alpine Space Ventures, we follow them closely and even made investments there in two of them.
Yeah, really exciting. And I think Johnny Dyer was also the one, when we met him in the US, saying that it's somehow like Silicon Valley, right? You had the first companies really, really, really growing, and then the employees actually started the second generation companies, and we now can see this moment in space with all the learnings from the first generation, right? So later, after SpaceX, you did a bigger career change, and you had a short interaction with Airbus. Can you tell us a bit what you did there and how that came?
Around 2014, I took a quick sabbatical from SpaceX. It wasn't even 2 years. I just took my leave at the end of 2014, having delivered Falcon 9 and Dragon and all of those things. And there was a little bit of a lull in the amount of work to be done in the avionics arena in the company. So I decided, hey, I'm going to walk away and take a little bit of a time off. And during that time, among many things that I have done, I also entered Airbus Defense and Space. Actually, it was back then the CEO, Dirk Holke, and the Airbus CEO, Tom Enders, that I had talked to. And they had a very big conviction that the company needed some amount of cultural shift, some amount of transformation, going digital and being competitive in the new space market. And I moved to Munich. I worked for the company for about half a year. And it was an interesting time. I saw a tremendous amount of technical excellence within the company. I saw many, many different sites and whatnot. But it came back down to what I talked about earlier. That company's business is a different one than I am used to. Mm-hmm. That company has the government as a customer and has a different way of dealing and impedance matching their customer. And that's what they need to do. But that's not an environment where I am it's not the environment where I'm the most productive. I left the company after half a year with a tremendous respect for the talent in the company and what they can do, but then decided to go back to SpaceX and do the mission assurance role for Starlink.
Yeah. And after that, exactly, mission assurance role at Starlink, you moved on to ultimately become the CEO of the company Mynaric. How did that happen?
So I stayed in Starlink for close to 2 years, and I was the VP of Mission Assurance, which meant I oversaw the technical execution and, to a certain extent, the business side of the execution as well. I was based in Los Angeles, but the team was up in Seattle, so I was the guy who went back and forth to Seattle and tried to bridge the culture between the two locations. And that was an exciting job, but overall, it was a tough job to do. Working with a team that was not local to me, and I didn't have the ultimate design decision either. So end of 27, I decided to leave SpaceX and take all the experience and now take a whole different role within the industry, which was to engage as a mentor. I realized that what I really liked doing in SpaceX, having been there from the earliest days, was to work with new employees coming in from school, looking at the opportunities that SpaceX has. They came with so much knowledge, but didn't know where they fit. And I really loved giving them guidance, growing them up within the company. So I said, let me do that a little bit more on my own and with founders outside. So I decided to become an angel investor and started engaging the European ecosystem, having my ties to Technical University in Munich. And I was at a conference, it was DLD back in the day. And that's where I met some people, an investor and someone from Mynaric that told me about what they're doing. And it was optical comms built in mass. And I said, this is exciting. I know what that can be for the space industry. It's the same as what happened to computers when you started networking them. This is what's happening to satellites when you network them. So I said, I'll join in and join the fight for you. And for a couple of years, I'll grow you to where you are, where you want to be. And that's exactly what I did. I joined the company. I knew about them a little bit during SpaceX, back in their old name, Violite, when, because you know, SpaceX is quite bullish on optical comms. So, and I entered the company and I love what they do. What they built is going to be very differentiating. And you have just the early prototype or a mock-up of their product right there behind me.
Nice. Yeah. Sven and I are also big fans of Mynaric and following the company from the very early days. We were surprised back then that the company went public so early. And you just mentioned like the vision. It's really like, you need to plan like a decade or maybe two decades until the full potential comes out, right? And now the company went public that early, and SpaceX is like the opposite example, right? So what yep. do you think like for these space companies? What is the right approach? Is there a right approach regarding going public or not?
Yeah. Mynaric went public in 2017, so about 2 years before I entered them. That was in the German stock exchange, and if you see what they were faced with, it was the right decision. As you said, a lot of people did not understand the space ecosystem, and it was not like there was a healthy private financial market in Europe to support companies like Mynaric. So they decided to take the hard route of going public, and it was one of the only decisions in their hands. And of course, it's not an easy place for a company like that to be. I think it's tremendous potential. I think since that time, they built a backlog that's impressive. They have really rolled out into the U.S. market. They have grown their workforce, went into mass production facilities. They are the largest winner of the Space Development Agency's constellation, which is the DoD's biggest space constellation. So they have done a lot of work, but the stock market's a number-driven game, and less about future potential, more about bottom-line numbers right now. And for a pre-revenue or early revenue company, it's a tough place to be. So I would say that staying on the private side longer is the right thing to do. And now, of course, with Alpine Space Ventures and many other VCs that we work with and know in our environment, there is a healthy private market today, and companies can afford to stay private much longer until they hit the maturity to be able to be listed public.
Yeah, and exactly. I think the role at Mynaric was until mid of 2023, which then marked more than 18 years in the space ecosystem. Now, obviously, you continued in the industry, but what exactly motivates you every morning to be pumped for exactly a day ahead?
Space, just space. Let's face it. I'm since I've been a kid, and you told me it's my kindergarten. Since kindergarten, I love I love being involved in everything space. Behind me somewhere is my kindergarten diploma that says loves building rockets out of Legos and loves anything space. And it's a topic that's so fascinating. What I like about it is it's difficult. It's extremely multidisciplinary. Their margins are thin. By that I mean the technical margins are thin. And you have to really make a perfect product to be successful. But that's the exciting part of it. Some of the best people work in that domain. They contribute to those products. And once you make it, you're in rarefied air and you are very successful. I think SpaceX has shown that. And I love being a part of it. I like challenging myself. It's like, I actually said that about SpaceX. It's like, it's an ecosystem where I just went into SpaceX and I realized I was always the dumbest person in the room. It's like, it always happens that way. And I think that's the way anyone in SpaceX feels like, because it is filled with really good talent, especially in these areas where people are trying to be disruptive, and you learn something every day. And space is an uncharted territory. They will teach you something every day.
Yeah.
So that's, I think you can only get motivated by that.
And I think both Danny and I can subscribe to that. I think like it's that uncharted nature of the industry, right? It's not just like we're going to do marginal improvements of whatever, but we're trying to something which hasn't been done before in an area like we do software, right? But no one has analyzed satellite data at that scale, right? You have invested in hardware companies. You've worked at hardware companies which have done stuff which no one ever has done. And I think this is like super attractive.
Yeah. And I think it's also the motivation for us with the podcast, right, to talk to people to learn about these developments. We talked a lot about your personal career now, so we want to go and zoom out a bit to the ecosystem and your special perspective on the ecosystem. And we would like to start with like our perspective on the VC market in Europe. Like when Sven and I started the company in like 2017, 18, like we had the feeling there was no really European VC market focusing on space. No one really knew what's going on. So in our first round, where we went out end of 2018 and closed in 2019, no one really understood the ecosystem. And we have seen now that this has changed, and we see now really a lot of space dedicated VCs. Can you maybe, before talking about Alphonse Space, can you share your perspective how the VC landscape changed in the past 5 to 10 years when it is about space, and maybe also Europe versus US?
Yeah, the space ecosystem changed quite a bit, but it was really tough starts even on this side of the Atlantic. And just like I said, when I was leaving Stanford in 2004, a bunch of professors came to me and said, there is no such thing as commercial space. And we had a long list of failures, right? Even at SpaceX, when we wanted to look for a test site for testing our engines and stages, we took over the test site of Beale Aerospace. If you ever want to see a failure, and not because they were bad, but because they couldn't fit into the ecosystem they were in, how they failed, Beale Aerospace is a good one to read. And the founder's letter to the public about that failure. But early years of SpaceX, there was no such thing as space investments either. If you look at SpaceX's history, 2002 founding, 2008, the first VC money coming in. That's 6 years of out-of-pocket financing by Elon. And to a certain extent, customer financing, but nothing VC-like. And even then, it was very visionary VCs that got into the company, to a certain extent also because they were in network for Elon. That changed, of course. On this side of the Atlantic earlier, now there is, it's almost impossible to find someone who does not have some kind of a space investment. First of all, anyone you talk to, even family offices, they all say, oh yeah, I have either, it's at least a minor stake at SpaceX, yeah. through secondaries. And that gets them going because they see what has happened. What was a tiny little company is today the largest venture-backed company, private company. And that really attracts attention from not just the space enthusiasts like you and I, but also the financial world. They get attracted by space companies, what I said earlier. When you solve a problem and you do it successfully, you're in rarefied air, you have a technology moat, you have a market moat around you, and you get to defend it really well. And if you keep your momentum, by the time your competitors get to where you are, you have already done two steps ahead. So the financial investors really started liking it. That happened in the US. And US, of course, had the advantage of a large DoD market, NASA, government, and everything. Europe trailed. It needed to wake up at a certain point, and it thought that the European way of centralized space management, top-down government-dictated space ecosystem, was the right way to go. And still there are pockets in Europe who think that everyone working on a single rocket designed by a bunch of politicians is the way to do it, and it's just not. And some people woke up to it. Some people saw the talent in Europe. Some people saw what the universities are putting out. Some people looked at US and realized there's a bunch of European talent since the 60s. Let's face it, also, you look at the moon landing, it's still European talent that did a lot of contributions there and said, we can do this here. And a few governments realized that as well and gave them a chance. And then came the VC money. And today we see venture capital money in Europe entering the game. Not just space specialists like us, but also generalists. And the amount of emails we get over at ASV from this or that VC saying, hey, we saw this deal. We really like the founders. There's a lot of energy here. But can you look at it? Let's go into this together. It really excites us because it's some VC that has done some software as a service, maybe some batteries, this or that. And now they don't shy away from looking at a space company. And they know they can always email us and just ask for our opinion. So to a certain extent, we are trying to also build more momentum by just being a sherpa in that environment.
Yeah. Which exactly brings us to Alpine Space Ventures, which is the VC fund you co-founded. And you are investing in space companies, as the name says. Obviously, nearly every VC, if not a total generalist, has a thesis about what the future winners could look like or how the future winners could look like. And we know that you also have a thesis around how the short-term or mid-term future winners in the space ecosystems look like. Could you shine some light on that?
Absolutely. So my co-founder Yoram and I are extremely excited about space. And we have a long-term vision too. And we are excited about everything that's going to happen in space, from asteroid mining to human space exploration, and people will live interplanetary and whatnot, but that doesn't make an investment.
Yeah.
We are excited and we're going to follow them. But in the short term and medium term, we have our first fund, Alpine Space Ventures Fund 1, and that one has a 10-year horizon that started in 2021. And we need to return to our investors lucrative returns.
Yeah.
How is that going to happen is if we are going to have exits along the way of our companies. And the best way to have exits is focusing on the side of the ecosystem that's about commercialization of services and products that serve terrestrial needs, a value chain around terrestrial needs. And we believe there are two terrestrial needs that are established. There's a customer base that's ever expanding, and there is a tremendous appetite for it. And that's connectivity, and that's data. And specifically, when we say data, it's space data being captured and analyzed. Those two really excite us. Those are places where we believe, when you look at other investment firms as well, or the big banks, they see a tremendous rise in the next 10 years. When we look at the fact that there's going to be 100,000 satellites at the end of the decade, generating data or connecting people, some people have to build those satellites. They have to build components. They have to launch them. They have to make sure they don't collide with each other through services from the ground. And for the ones that generate data, there is a whole value chain that comes beyond it. That data needs to be hosted. And I actually believe Earth observation will come into its full value when we start putting it into a platform, normalizing it from multiple sources, multiple different types of data, merging it even with non-space captured data and really building truths out of it and analyzing it. So we believe there's a platform potential, normalized data access, a data market, an analysis market that goes all the way to end customer, and of course, all the analysis companies. So we believe in all of that. And I think those are the places where over the next 10 years, there's going to be big winners. And within that, I think we're looking into pick and shovel builders. We're not looking into binary outcome companies that are way too far right in the value chain, but really companies that will benefit from the ecosystem growing and growing and growing. And we know this 100,000. I think we're going to be over that by the end of the day.
Yeah, super cool. I mean, one question could be asked is that the Earth observation, right, Telco, we all know Starlink and the other constellation which are coming up. On the Earth observation side, constellations already have been around a little longer than that. But though there's no multi-billion or tens of billions of dollars company out there in the Earth observation system yet, right? LifeYo wants to be that company at one point in time. But maybe what do you think? What's holding the Earth observation industry back at the moment?
I think in Earth observation, the most amazing thing is Earth observation can serve hundreds of markets, thousands of markets.
Yeah.
You sit down with Earth observation data and you start writing down what it could serve and what it could do. You could be there for months.
Yeah.
But that is also its problem, is the fact that each one of those markets need to be captured one by one by one by one. And in each one single customer segment is not enough to make the company profitable. So you need to fold the earnings from one to the next, to the next, to the next, until you have critical mass. And I think that slows down Earth observation. It doesn't make it impossible, but it slows down Earth observation because there's a lot of customer education to be made. We all know how much it can help farmers, and we know how much it can help traders and insurance companies and logistics companies, you name it. But each one of those customer segments is a new or a novice user of space technology that has to be convinced first to even open up their pockets. We see the first signs. John Deere's involvement is a big deal. BayWa having a space department looking at space, that big deal. But it's taking its time. And if you look at Earth observation companies today, the ones that have been able to rise rapidly are the ones that have been able to tap into the dual use side of that business, serving government needs. There's a big pot of money there. Bringing up the quality and the product to a level, and then starting to hire dedicated business development managers in each one of the verticals and engaging the ecosystem to now add the hockey stick with the commercial side. But
yeah,
we don't have that yet. As you said, we don't have that company yet, but I am sure it'll be built.
Yeah, and I want to cite the CEO of the Bezos Earth Fund, who said at Planet Explore last year in Washington that just imagine we had sensed the planet since 20 years, how we're doing it today. How would the world look like, right? It would be a complete different place. One thing following up on what you said is, we see the automation, the degree of automation is a very challenging thing, right, which we are working on. But the second thing, which is now connected to the hardware, is the cost of data in general. Okay. And what do you think, where are we right now in the cost reduction and then also the price reduction in Earth observation data, and how will initiatives like Starship change this and over what time horizon?
Let's look into the cost factor of getting that data, right? 20 years ago, the dominant factor in any space mission was the launch, or at least it was half of it. You were paying $100-150 million just to put up a satellite up there, and you were putting these giant satellites because of it, because you wanted to send the most amazing thing up there. When you're paying so much for launch anyways, it made more sense to spend $150 million to send a $5 million. That changed dramatically by multiple effects. First of all, the per dollar cost of launch has decreased. So if you're taking dedicated launches on SpaceX, you're looking at a $1,500, $2,000 a kilogram kind of launch. That number, of course, goes up when you're doing a rideshare mission, because there's a lot of organization and dead mass that the company is taking up for that. But you're still looking at that $4,000-$5,000 a kilogram. That's not so dominant, such that it makes sense now to send smaller, more cheaper satellites up there. And that changed the bottom. Second step that then happened is satellite builders being given a trial and error approach to the space industry, decided to take the heritage hardware and completely change it. We all know heritage electronics from the 60s, 70s, 80s that the whole satellite industry was built on was absolutely lacking any performance whatsoever from being able to deal with the tremendous amount of data an imager throws at. In the meantime, we have tried every Xilinx chip, every imaging chip there is out there, and know which one works and which one doesn't. And most of them are terrestrial chips. Sure, the satellite doesn't live for 15 years, but if a chip that costs me 1,000 times less only works half the time, I am still 500x better off in the bottom line. So satellites have gotten cheap. Sure, there are limits to it. And I think that's where Starship comes in. At the end of the day, you have this physical phenomenon, the diffraction limit. You want to have a good resolution, you have to have big optics. It just defines your possible resolution is the aperture of the imager. That's just the way it is. And at some point, that drives volume of the satellite. So still there is a certain amount of cost associated with generating data that's of higher quality. That once again goes back down to launch costs. And that's going to change with Starship, because now we're looking at a sub 100 kilogram launch capability. And suddenly building things mass and volume efficient is not important anymore. What is important is capability quickly up to space, and the capability is more important than mass and volume savings. And that's exactly why we're also very bullish on not just constellation satellites of medium class, we are very bullish on ultra large satellites as well, and made an investment in there.
Yeah, and K2 Space. And maybe K2 Space, I think, is a US-based company, right?
Yes.
But you've invested most of the in most of your portfolio, most of your investments in your portfolio are European-based. So maybe on that topic, so what's your view on the European role in the new space ecosystem globally?
I think what Europe needs to do, and I think they're seeing more and more of that, is stop talking itself small. Europe, when we talk about it, is more people than the US. It has capabilities. It has some of the best universities, especially when it comes to hardware. It has some industries it dominated for years. It has capabilities in mass manufacturing. It has capabilities in chemistry and in earth sciences and really just sciences that are fantastic, physics. Some of the best institutes of the world are in the US, so in Europe. So we got to speak our, like, we got to not speak ourselves small in there, saying, oh, our market is so small and therefore we should not approach it. No, opposite. I think we can take a leadership role, and it's a free market. At least the Western space economy has become a free market. We don't have to constantly just put up the European flag and say, hey, European company, European market. No, it should be European company, global market. We should be able to step up to the plate against US counterparts. And that's exactly what we should be doing. Are there geographic limitations? Yeah, I think US having better access to oceans make launching out of US a little bit easier. But besides that, building satellites, going ahead and building software and analysis companies in Europe is absolutely practical and doable, and we support that. And we're going to have global winners out of it, just like we had in the automotive industry, in the software industry, in the ERP, for example. We have in chemistry, in many other arenas, we have global dominant players, and that's what we're going to do.
That's it's super interesting. What you also invested in K2 Space, because if you go 5-10 years back, everything was about CubeSat and miniaturization, right? Did you already back then thought, no, there will be super large satellites, and that is a very contrarian view of the space ecosystem, right?
Well, it's odd for someone who worked on some of the earliest CubeSats to say it, but I think CubeSat in itself is a great tool, but not the final product. I think CubeSats can be fantastic to try out a concept, build a company structure, get engineering going for a startup without spending too much CapEx and whatnot. But I always thought that a company will bounce from there to medium class. the 100, 200, 500 kilogram satellites. And that's why we did the investment into Reflex. We believe that side of the market is the most business associated side of the satellite market. And we are excited about that. But it was really with the onset of Super Heavy launch that these really large satellites made sense. We knew there was always a business for it, but that was very limited because it was some satellites that cost in the billions to make for the NROs, the NSAs, the CIAs of the world that really want those big satellites. And then suddenly it wasn't those three-letter agencies anymore. It was really with the oncoming of Starship and the thought about direct-to-device communication. People started getting excited about large satellites with large structures that can have big antennas or Earth observation, thinking, hey, certain problems require ridiculously high resolution to solve. So with all of that, with the oncoming Starship, I started thinking about that thing.
Yeah. So please also invest in a company that is building optics, because like optics are still like biggest cost driver for Earth observation satellite. But that's on another note. I can tell you more about this offline. But now coming to the last question from my side, what is your most contrarian view about the space ecosystem you think most people wouldn't share? Is there any perspective which is very contrarian to the mass opinion?
Contrarian views are hard to have in space because I think everyone has their own view. I think the one thing I would say is, if you're looking into investing space today, I think you've got to look into the value chain. And for some reason, everyone's focus has went to the start, the launch side of things. The number of launch companies in the world is unsustainable. And I've done my investment into ESAR Aerospace, and I love the company. And I think they are one of the few that are going to, I think, make it big. But that is focusing on the part of the market that is at the start. And there is a whole value chain to be built behind it. So this is a place to be active. I think the winners of the launch segment is pretty much cast, and there's very few candidates to make it into there. I think let's start thinking about satellites. What can be done with that value? What can be done with the component side of things? I still believe that most financial investors are either all the way to the left. They do a copycat investment from SpaceX or ESAR or other very successful rocket companies. Or they go really right in the customer, all the way to the customer side, and do the really, really back end of the value, but they don't look at the middle, the satellite builders, the component builders, that will make the whole value chain actually work. And that's a place that we like to focus in, these pick and shovel builders of people who build propulsion systems, solar panels, and carbon composite pieces, or build the satellites. And I think the whole ecosystem and the whole value chain will benefit from that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think I at one point in time saw that there are 150 different small launch builders out there, and I was wondering, okay, good. Well, if you already have like dozens in Europe, who will buy from all these different operators? But anyways, different story. Final question before we have to end this podcast, unfortunately. But we think that you most likely know the integrated space plan. For the listeners who don't know the integrated space plan, it's a 100-year plan from the company Rockwell for the exploration of outer space. Where do you think we're going to be in 100 years from now in terms of space exploration?
I think 100 years from now, we're not talking about space exploration in the way, hey, anytime you leave Earth, it's space exploration. Today, we do ocean exploration, right? Still do. But there are certain pockets of the ocean that we look at, but we use the oceans for trade. We all use the oceans and the whole Earth for the world's economy. Space is not going to be different. We are going to have 100 years from now, we're going to be definitely settling the closest planetary bodies and their moons. I think Moon and Mars is definitely being integrated into human society and industry. But besides that, I think we have started working on the asteroid belt. and seeing what the elements there can enable us. The other day, I was talking about the impacts of AI, and I really said one of the biggest things about AI will be its knock-on effects. Yeah. I think engineering will change considerably. The output of humans will increase dramatically by using AI. You won't have to do every minutia in doing a design. You will be able to do iterations faster and faster and faster, and technology cycles will get shorter. That will immediately put a strain on production. Mm-hmm. So production companies and additive manufacturing will come to the front of a lot of industries. But once that is solved, and we're getting better and better and better in additive manufacturing. Remember, I invested into my friend's company, Freeform, just because of that. We're going to get better at it. And what's going to happen is we're going to be then constrained, both intellectually and by output, by raw material. Because we have limited raw material on Earth, especially of specific kind, heavy metals and whatnot.
Yeah.
That best source of that is space. That in itself will drive a certain amount of spacefaring civilization because it just integrates with every industry.
Wow, there's so much to unfold here, and I would love to dive much deeper into just your answer right now. But I think we unfortunately don't have time for that today. So it's a great cliffhanger, maybe to the second piece of this conversation. So thank you very much, Bülent. Before we have to say goodbye, we wanted to ask you, as we ask every podcast guest of ours, who should we have on the podcast in the future?
I think a great person to have is Bastian Behrens from Black Wave. He builds carbon composite products out of his company Black Wave. And he does that for, amongst others, the space industry. And because he already has so many conversations on both sides of the Atlantic to so many potential and current customers, he has a very good insight what's happening on both sides and knows the differences. I think he'd be a great guest.
Excellent. Great. Then we are looking forward to speaking to Bastian soon. But first of all, thank you very much, Bülent. It was really, really a pleasure for Danny and myself speaking to you. And also thanks to all the listeners for joining today. Make sure to connect with Bülent through LinkedIn. Exactly. Make sure to follow us and tune in next time. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, wherever. And looking forward to exactly continuing this conversation, hopefully in the future, Bülent.
Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you, Sven. It was a pleasure to be here.
All right, lift off, and the clock is started. Roger, speed. Perfect. The angle has landed. We choose to go to the moon in this extended mission. Roger, speed. Lift off. We have a lift off.